Tonight I want to share a magical alchemical formula. Ready for some magic? I want to talk about transforming suffering into happiness. Sounds pretty good. Are you ready? You might not realize it, but you're doing this, you've been doing this for the whole week, and you do it many times a day, although you might not understand the process that that you're undergoing from this perspective and how it works. But I wanted to share that with you tonight. This morning in the instructions, Yuha was talking about our reactions of mind. Do you remember that? And how easy it is to, when something is unpleasant, to react against it with aversion. You've seen that, haven't you? And the corollary to that is when something is pleasant, do you notice how you usually respond? I like this. How do I keep it here? What if it goes away? Please don't go away. And when something is not necessarily captivating, somebody brought up in the group today about boredom. How many people have noticed boredom during this week?
Yeah.
And what do? Either miss what's happening completely because it's not captivating us, or it soon turns to unpleasant because this isn't very entertaining or fun. The Buddha in the Discourse on Mindfulness, the second foundation of the four foundations of mindfulness, after mindfulness of the body and before mindfulness of mind states, the second foundation, which he thought was so important that he put it right there after the body, right after mindfulness of our experience in the body, is what's called mindfulness of the feeling tone of experience. Sometimes it's just simply translated as mindfulness of feelings, but that can be a misunderstanding because the feelings in this second foundation are not the emotions that we talked about this morning. Wait a second. Yeah, that we talked about, when was it? Yesterday, when I gave the instructions on mind states. This is the feeling tone of experience, the flavor of experience. In Pali, the word is Vedana, V-E-D-A-N-A. Some of you are quite familiar with this already. So bear with me. And simply put, every moment of our experience has one of three flavors. It is either a pleasant moment of experience, an unpleasant moment of experience, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant, often just simply called neutral moment of experience. That pretty much covers the territory, let's say. It's not that it's bad when it's one or the other. You know, the Buddha had pleasant moments of experience and unpleasant moments of experience and neutral moments of experience. He said, take a look at this and understand this is part of being alive. There will be one of those three in each moment. How we respond to those is the key to suffering or to happiness. When it is a pleasant moment of experience, most of us naturally like it and want to hold on to it, become attached to it. Yeah. Finally, life is cooperating with my plan. And we grasp attachment. When it's an unpleasant moment of experience, as was said, we naturally, most of us, want to push it away, either with aversion or aggression or ill will or the whole range of of the opposite of allowing, of aversion. This is suffering. And when it's a neutral moment of experience, most of us, it doesn't captivate our attention. So we look for something else or get lost in our mind. Well, maybe my fantasies are more interesting than this moment of breathing. Yeah. Let's go there. Or, oh my God, this is so boring. And then it becomes unpleasant. Those three responses to those three natural manifestations of life are the sources of suffering. They are called the three roots of suffering, or the three poisons, if you will. Greed, hatred, delusion, or a less extreme labeling, attachment, aversion, ignorance, or confusion. Every moment that we respond with one of those three, we are planting the seeds of suffering. There is another possibility. If one is really present and has practiced, when the moment is pleasant, it's possible to experience it, experience the pleasant, appreciate it without getting attached to it. Non-greed or non-attachment. If the moment is unpleasant, it's possible to respond without aversion, but simply experiencing it as it is. Oh, this is an unpleasant moment. I can be with this. Okay. Yeah, have you seen that? It's possible to be with an unpleasant moment. That is the response of non-hatred or non-aversion. And when the moment is not compelling, when it's neutral, but we're quite present, it's possible to be here for it and appreciate, oh, this moment is like this. Maybe you've started to, by now, at times be with the breath, which probably wasn't so compelling when you first got here, and now it's, oh, breathing in, breathing out, maybe at times. Or this moment of taking a step, oh, just walking, that's what's happening. That non-delusion or non-ignorance is a moment of clarity. So those three, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, or another way of saying it, non-greed, generosity, or the joy of letting go, which flowers as generosity, non-hatred or kindness, loving kindness. We've mentioned that once or twice this week. You've heard that. And non-delusion or clarity, seeing things clearly, are the three roots of happiness and well-being. So every moment that you are mindful of the Vedana, the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, without our usual reactivity, but simply responding with wisdom and clarity, we are not creating moments of suffering in our future, practicing that response, and we are sowing the seeds of happiness, both in the moment and in the future, as we practice this more and more. Every moment of mindfulness, remember that opening line of the Satipatthana Sutta, there is one most direct way to overcome sorrow, lamentation, and pain, anxiety, grief, despair, and that is, and realize the highest happiness, that is the establishment of mindfulness. So I wanted to talk a bit more in depth with about each of these three. And hopefully motivate you that much more to cultivate as many moments of happiness and through as many moments of mindfulness as you can. Just because it feels good. That's the kind of happiness that's very different than, oh, this feels so good. It's the happiness of just being with experience as it is. So, oops. So the first, non-greed, or the capacity to let go, and the full expression of it as a generous heart. Remember at the beginning, we talked about expansion and contraction. The contracted heart, the contracted citta, heart or mind, is trying to hold experience, trying to capture it. And the wholesome, fulfilling response is not holding on and expressing our generosity. And really, one way to think of this, if you are familiar with the Four Noble Truths, the first truth, there is suffering in life. The second truth, the cause of suffering is the wanting mind. The third truth, the end of suffering, is letting go of the grasping mind, the attached mind. The third truth, the end of suffering, freedom, liberation, awakening, the end of suffering. So really, one way to think of this is moving from the second truth, the cause of suffering, to the third truth, the end of suffering. It goes against the grain and against all of our conditioning when the moment is pleasant, or when we have some kind of hope or expectation of what we think might happen. Have you noticed that when you sit down? I wonder what this one's going to be like. Oh, it was so good this morning or 2 days ago, whatever it was. And that hope or expectation is setting ourselves up for life to either pass or fail our test. So to let go of that expectation and to simply be with things as they are, tremendous freedom. This is from a great Tibetan master. I'll just read a little of it. Happiness cannot be found through great effort or willpower, but is already here in relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There's nothing to do. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you relax this grasping, space is here, open, inviting, and comfortable. I remember on my first retreat, I shared this in one of the groups, I'd been practicing for some time, and on my first retreat, I sat, and I never had this experience before where it didn't matter if the bell never rang. You ever have one of those? You know. By the way, if the bell rings and you're in that space, you don't have to get up. There's no law that says, now we have to go walking. No, you can enjoy it. And I did for a while. And I got so excited, I couldn't wait to tell my teacher. Unfortunately, between that experience and the time I had the interview, I had all kinds of experiences. I was so excited, and then I didn't get there, and I was discouraged, and then I was exhausted, and then I got a little calm, and I was all over the map. You know? And I said to him, when I saw him a day and a half later, I said, I had it, then I lost it. How do I get it back again? And he looked at me and he told me, this is my first retreat, bless his heart. He said, at one point in his own practice, he'd been practicing in India for a number of years, and he had gotten to this place where every time he sat in this rhythm that he was in, his body was filled with light and his mind was so clear. And it was happening for some time. And then he went back to the States. He had to take care of some business. And then he came back to Asia, knowing he was going to practice diligently again and remembering very well how it was. And he said, oh, I can't wait to go back. He said, I sat down and my mind was like mud and my body was like twisted steel. Mm-hmm. He said, I spent nearly 2 years trying to recapture that experience. Then he leaned forward, I'll never forget. He said, I was the dummy. I did it for you. You don't have to be the dummy. Thank you, Joseph. And that was, what a gift, that first retreat where I got, it's not about getting to any fantastic experience. It's about being with things as they are, because they're going to change. But we get so caught up in, yeah, I want to have the grasping mind, the second noble truth. And this is both in our meditation practice and, of course, in our life. This is what the disease of modern humanity is, the disease of more. Our consumer society on this finite planet of resources, and we are so gripped in it. Not that many people get this, even and sometimes especially those who have been given so much. When John D. Rockefeller, American, I don't know if people have ever heard of John D. Rockefeller, or Rockefeller, maybe you heard of Rockefeller. He was the richest man in the world at the time, and somebody asked him, Mr. Rockefeller, how much money will be enough? And he said, just a little more. How painful. How painful. As opposed to the Buddhist concept of moderation, Matanuta. This is from the scholar P.A. Paiuto. He says, it is an awareness of that optimum point where the enhancement of true well-being coincides with the experience of satisfaction. Consumption balanced to an amount appropriate with well-being rather than to the satisfaction of endless desires. In contrast to maximum consumption leading to more satisfaction, we have moderate or wise consumption leading to well-being. Makes sense, doesn't it? And yet, how many times have I seen myself go for that dessert was really great. Second helping. Yeah. Not as great, but it's still really good. Third helping. Too much. Too much on your plate, you get indigestion. And there we are, gripped in this disease of more, whereas the beautiful quality of the generosity of heart, or that ability to say, okay, here's enough, it's the sweet spot, just enough. That's wisdom. It takes some mindfulness to really know when enough is enough. I don't know if people ever said, you know, enough is enough. Mm-hmm. Well, it's really wise. Oh, enough is really enough. Oh. Mm. And not only to know when enough is enough and let go of that wanting more, but that full expression, which is to share. How beautiful it is to share. Dana, generosity, the first of the paramitas, even before wisdom and effort and morality and patience and loving kindness, the Buddha would teach dana first of the 10 perfections. Because it feels really good to share, and it is both the expression of letting go and the connection that we have with each other. I have a cup on my bathroom. It's the last of four cups given to my wife and me for our wedding. 1982 is one left. Okay. Every day I brush my teeth, rinse my mouth. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Francis, because it was their wedding gift to me, to us. It's my cup now. It's on my side of the scene. But it's that currency of caring where you're feeling that connection. Think of something in your house, perhaps, a gift that someone gave you, a sweater, or something in your kitchen, or something that you've given to someone else, a gift that you gave to someone else, but particularly when it's something that you see every time, regularly. Don't you think of that person who gave it to you? It's the currency of caring. So it's beautiful. It's not just the stuff. It's the energy of love that we can share with each other through that material dimension. Shanti Deva, I think I might have, I quoted from him at the end of the first talk. And this one line in that quote, he said, the miracle of awakening lifts us above poverty into the wealth of giving to life. I love that line. It says, above poverty, that small scarcity mind, oh, I don't know if I'll have enough, to into the wealth of giving to life. We all know this, how good it feels to give. Martin Seligman, who is the father of positive psychology, who wrote this book, Authentic Happiness, who has studied happiness for decades, he said, the greatest happiness, the most authentic happiness that humans can experience, he has seen in his research, is identifying what our gifts are and offering them in a spirit of contribution to others. It feels good to share. And the most noble and fulfilling expression of that is service, is making a contribution, making a difference in this world, whether it's some bigger principle or just caring for those who touch our hearts. One of my inspirations, Harvey, what's his name? Hope. I'm blanking that. Andrew Harvey, thank you. Ooh, just a brain cell just didn't fire there. Andrew Harvey, he wrote a book called The Hope, A Guide for Sacred Activists. And he says, follow your heartbreak. Wherever it happens to be, follow where your heart is breaking and express your caring because it's so fulfilling. And this is the Bodhisattva ideal from Nyosho Kempo Rinpoche, another great Tibetan teacher. He says, we are not practicing for ourselves alone, since everyone is involved and included in the great scope of this perfectly pure motivation to benefit others. Whatever else we might do in practice is secondary to that, he believes. And if we cultivate this good heart, this altruistic, unselfish attitude, then all strife and struggle will naturally be pacified, purified, and transformed in us and become beneficial to others through contact with this good heart, which we, the Bodhisattvas, strive to embody. So, every moment that you are mindful of a pleasant experience and don't grasp at it, but can simply enjoy and appreciate it and then let it go, you're sowing powerful seeds of well-being. Second, non-hatred or kindness. We've talked a lot about it because it is so key. It is the source of tremendous well-being. Every moment when there's an aversive or an unpleasant experience and we don't push away, but we can be with this, we're practicing a different response to the unpleasant. And we can practice this. You can practice it. I'm sure you get a lot of chances to practice it on this retreat when somebody, you know, maybe breathes loudly near you, or somebody puts a lot of food on their plate and says, and you look, my goodness, or whatever. We can find lots of different things. There's a phenomenon probably many of you are familiar with. There is one phenomenon called the Vipassana romance, or VR, and then where somebody just lights you up on the retreat. Maybe you have touched that here. Then there's the opposite, the Vipassana vendetta, or VV. On one retreat, It was my it was my first 3-month retreat, and in the middle of this retreat, we had Zen Week, where we all sat around the perimeter of the meditation hall, and that was your spot for the week. And we sat Zen style and, you know, tried to be like samurai warriors. In my mind, at least I did. Okay, we're doing Zen this week. And the guy next to me, unfortunately, had this really bad cough, sitting right next to me where we were stuck for a week. And I'd be sitting and then, and then I kind of settled down. And it was irregular and quite jarring. And I thought, oh my God, this is going to be a long week. And thankfully, I said, I've got to figure out something, because this was my spot. I couldn't even go to my room. They could tell when you're not in your spot. So I said, okay, every time he coughs, I'm going to see if I was mindful or not. I'd be sitting. Yeah, I was here. Yeah. Oh, I was gone. Come on back. And he became my checker for the month to see if I was being mindful. It was fantastic. You know? I couldn't wander very long, very far. Yeah, here I am. He started to get a little bit better as the week went on. I felt good for him, but I missed it a little bit. You can turn a VV into your ally. But on the other hand, there is not just accepting the unpleasant and turning that hatred or aversion into kindness. We are developing loving kindness. We're developing loving kindness for ourselves. I hope you've started to get glimpses of that, if not profound experiences of that, how transformative it is. And this has come out in some of the groups. It's been so beautiful to see when people see, oh, I can actually be kind with myself. You can read about it in a book. You can have everybody in your life line up and say, you really are good. But until you see for yourself, oh, there's a good person in here, you don't get the actual experience. So if you've tasted that at all, keep cultivating that. That is a key to profound awakening. And I know what this is like to not like myself, and I know what it's like to actually change. And I thought I'd share with you, some of you have known, have heard me share this before, but since this is a chance I get, and not everybody has, I want to share with you a loving kindness practice that really was transformative for me many years ago. When I was doing a loving kindness, a metta practice, 6 weeks of metta, and met the four Brahmaviharas. The first 2 weeks were metta, and then karuna, mudita, and upekkha, equanimity. And I was instructed the first week to just send metta to myself, because that's, once you get that going, then it's easier to send it to everyone else. So there I was, and you do it from the moment you wake up until the time you go to bed. You're planting those seeds with phrases. May I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy. may I live with ease. Those are my phrases. And you just say it again and again and again in a pace that works for you, trying to get in touch with the feeling as well, and just being with whatever is happening. So there I was doing it very diligently, as I would do. I can be a diligent yogi, and I was going for it. And it was okay. It wasn't great, but by that time I wasn't beating myself up in my practice. But, you know, I wasn't doing somersaults saying, being in love with myself. And in the middle of this week, somebody popped into my consciousness who I knew really loved me. There was no doubt in my mind that person loved me. And I said to myself, this would be so much easier if I could just see what they see. And then brilliantly, I connected the dots and I said, well, what do they see anyway? Why do they love me so much? And that's when I hit upon this way of doing the metta practice. And I just want to offer it to you right now. So if you would just go inside for a moment. And bring to mind someone who really loves you, or who really, you know, that they just delight in who you are. Not necessarily a complicated relationship. Somebody, when you're with, it's really easy between you. And maybe have an image of them right now in front of you in your mind, smiling back at you. Oh, thanks for picking me. Hi. And feel that energy that you both share when the two of you get together. Enjoy that for a moment. And now, imagine inhabiting their body and their reality and seeing through their eyes who they see when they're with their friend. All the things that touch them about you. Maybe your kindness or your care or your playfulness or your honesty. See all of it, your goodness, what shines out from you without you even trying. And then imagine what they would wish for you, just for you to be happy and for you to see what they see. Imagine them sending those thoughts to you. I hope you see who I see. May you truly be happy. And now let your consciousness travel back so that it's right inside your own body. And remember what your friend sees. And stay connected to it. And send those thoughts to yourself. You can say either, may I, or you can speak to yourself, may you see all the goodness inside. May you share your love well. Letting whatever your experience be, just how it was, if that didn't connect with you, that's okay. Just hold that. But if you got a glimpse, even a glimpse, you can't pretend anymore that you're not worthy of love or that you can't see who you really are. When I did that, it wasn't like I was the most amazing person in the world. It was so simple. It was just, you know, you're a good guy. That was it. Nothing huge, just you're a decent guy. Oh, who knew? Wow. And if you met somebody who understood you really well, who had your sense of humor, who appreciated your take on the world, or understood your hopes and your fears, who really got you, wouldn't you like meeting someone who really gets you? There's one person that gets every joke that goes through your head. Only one. Unfortunately, they're right inside your body. But if you met yourself from the outside, you'd be saying, what a neat human being this person is. Where have you been all my life? So this first aspect of loving ourselves, or at least learning to embrace and accept the whole package and see our goodness underneath it, so key. Then you can really start to see all the goodness in others from a whole other dimension, because you see your foibles, your imperfections, and you're learning to accept them. And you see other people just getting lost in their own confusions, and you see their goodness. If you look for their goodness, you have a better shot at bringing it out of them. That's a main practice of mine. Keep looking for the good. You won't always be able to, but generally, when people can feel you seeing their goodness, they relax around you, and it actually draws them out. Then there's not only loving ourselves and starting to learn to feel that for others, but on a whole deeper level, it's loving something beyond yourself or another. Loving life. Loving the Dharma. Why is it that you're here doing all of this work? There's something in you that's calling you that you can't ignore. But as Buddhists, we often miss that. We don't feel the juice often in Buddhist meditation practice. Oh yes, seeing things clearly and seeing suffering and the cause of suffering and the end of suffering and the path to the end of suffering. Love sometimes gets lost in the shuffle. And I'll share with you a story some of you have heard a number of times. Again, another key story about my relationship to practice. When I was first getting into practice, I had come from, I'm wearing my Be Here Now shirt. This is the cover of the book that changed my life by Ram Dass. And it's a devotional, it's a bhakti practice. And the Ram Dass, who was one of my two main teachers, and his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, something happened when I read that book, and it just opened my heart in a way that I couldn't explain, still can't explain. But then I got into Buddhist practice, which was such a powerful way for me to cultivate this purification of mind. But it became very isolated. I went back to New York City from summer in Colorado, And there was no Sangha there at all. And I just had my own apartment that I was sitting in and that I was living in and meditating very, very diligently. But it was really dry because it can get lonely when there's no one to practice with. And Joseph, my other teacher, said, "Hey, Ram Dass is doing this course, this invitation-only class. You might go there. I know you really like him." And Ram Dass was very close with Joseph. He said, "Go check it out." I said, "Okay." And I had my first interview with Ram Dass to see if it was appropriate. And because everybody is doing chanting and mala beads and Sri Ram, J Ram and stuff like that. And I'm in, out, hearing, thinking, you know, to see if this would fit. And, you know, I was the Buddhist. And I said, "Will it work?" And he said, "Let's see." And then he asked me in that very memorable first interview, he said, "Well, let me ask you, this is a devotional scene. How do you feel about Jesus?" I said, he said, "Do you love Jesus?" I said, "I like Jesus." I don't know if I love Jesus. I love his teachings, but I don't know if I love Jesus. He said, "All right. How about Krishna? Do you love Krishna?" "I like Krishna." The expression of celebration and dancing and loving life. "But I can't say honestly that I love Krishna." He said, "Okay." He said, "Well, how about God? Do you love God?" And I said, "You know, I was raised Jewish, like he was." And I said, "Maybe some kid's Bible picture book when I was young gave me this image, but I have this image of this very powerful being with a big beard and a big book and a big pen or pencil, I don't know what it was, saying, 'You're going to have a good day and you're not.'" And so rather than loving God, it more put the fear of God in me. So when I hear the word God, I translate it in my mind as the Dharma, which to me is like the perfection of it all, the mystery. And he said, "Okay." He said, "Well, do you love the Dharma?" There was no hesitation. I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "You sure?" I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "Have you ever told the Dharma that you loved it?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, go ahead." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Say, 'I love you, Dharma.'" I said, "Really?" He said, "I'll say it with you. You start." I felt kind of stupid. I said, "I love you, Dharma." And he said, "I love you, Dharma." He said, keep going. "I love you, Dharma." And by about the third or fourth time, I felt it. Tears streaming down my cheeks. At which point he said, "Oh, there's hope for you yet." And I think it's something that we all would be served by getting in touch with, whether you call it the Dharma or God or whatever feeling you have for it. There's something that's called you here that's more than just an intellectual curiosity. Maybe that was the motivation. Check this out. But at some point, to stay here for 5 days now, you there's something that's been touched by you. And the more we can get in touch with that, the whole practice takes on a whole different level of connection. So, non-hatred or kindness or loving kindness, that juicy aspect of practice. And every moment that you're with the unpleasant and you don't push it away with aversion, but can welcome it, say, ah, okay, and there's this moment, and welcome it with friendliness and even an open-hearted, loving awareness, you are sowing the seeds for powerful happiness and well-being. Non-delusion or wisdom. To see clearly, that's what I think I said it the first night, the definition of vipassana is to see things clearly. And this is a radical invitation that the Buddha gave. There are what are called the vipalasas, the three distortions of reality, that is taking what is impermanent to be permanent, taking what is a source of suffering to be a source of happiness, and taking what is the selfless nature of reality to be some solid separate entity. Those are the three distortions. And the three characteristics of existence that wisdom reveals is everything changes. Have you noticed that by now? I hope you have. Holding on to changing experience is a sure prescription for suffering. And that we too are this changing flow of experience. And when we see that, particularly that last one, we liberate ourselves from the central knot of experience of our suffering, that is thinking we can control life or should control at least what's going on in here, that we should be able to control our minds or our thoughts or our body. The Buddha in the second sutta after the Four Noble Truths, his first discourse, which one of his five cohort travelers became enlightened. The second discourse, the other four became enlightened, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, where he said, this form is not you. You do not own this form. If you owned this form, this body, you could say, knee, stop hurting. Shoulder, be gentle. Organs, keep serving me. You don't control this body. It has its own laws. You don't control this mind. I want to just have happy thoughts. Good luck. You don't control it. You don't control this heart. You are this flow of experience where life is moving through you, and there's no one place that you can say, this is me, because it's all in continual transformation. So we can train the mind, but we can't. We have limited control over what comes up in any moment. And when we see this whole process, including our thought patterns, are just causes and conditions, habits of mind that lead us in one way and can be trained, or that this body is subject to old age, sickness, and death, we have a different orientation and letting go of thinking we have agency that we never had in the first place. And when we see that, when we see that we are not separate from the rest of life, this is just life happening through us, as us, it changes our relationship to everything. There's a wonderful story by J.D. Salinger. You probably have heard of J.D. Salinger, Catcher in the Rye. Is that something that people read in Finland? He wrote this one book, short stories, and one story is, it's called Teddy, of this awakened 12-year-old. And he's being interviewed, and the interviewer says, "How did awakening happen in you?" And he said, "Oh, I was about 9, and I was watching my sister at breakfast drinking her glass of milk. And suddenly it occurred to me, it was God pouring God into God." You get it? This is from a poet I love, Daniel Bayless. He says, "You are but a collection of atoms working together in temporary harmony before being dispersed back into the universe. Your earthly task is to help those atoms radiate. Imagine the simplicity. You need not achieve anything but gently glow." You are a collection of atoms working together in temporary harmony before being dispersed back into the universe. Your earthly task is to help those atoms radiate. Imagine the simplicity. You need not achieve anything but gently glow. And this non-delusion, the irony is you don't see clearly by lots of effort. You actually open to it when you let go of all of that doing and you just rest in natural awareness, where you stop your doing and you just learn to relax and be. This is from another great Rinpoche, Tibetan, Nyosho Kempo again, this was. "Rest in natural great peace, this exhausted mind, beaten helplessly by karma and neurotic thoughts, like the relentless fury of the pounding waves in the infinite ocean of samsara. Rest in natural great peace." How simple. How difficult. Until you experience for yourself how simple. Tomorrow we'll, in the morning meditation, we'll do a bit of practice in this. And you see, it's all about letting go and simply resting and being. So every moment that you see clearly, a neutral moment where you see, oh, and this is a moment of life, without feeling bored, or without getting confused or without wanting more entertainment, but see, ah, let me be here for this moment. And it starts revealing these three characteristics. Oh, how things change. Nothing to hold on to. Ah, life is amazing. You are cultivating very powerful seeds of well-being. I'll share with you one more poem around this resting in awareness. Settle in the here and now. Reach down into the center, where the world is not spinning, and drink this holy peace. Feel relief flood into every cell. Nothing to do, nothing to be but what you are already. Nothing to receive but what flows effortlessly from the mystery into form. Nothing to run from or run toward. Just this breath, awareness, knowing itself as embodiment. Just this breath, awareness, waking up to truth. Every moment that you are mindful, you are weakening the habits of greed, hatred, and delusion, and strengthening the habits of non-greed, letting go and generosity, non-hatred, loving-kindness, non-delusion, clarity, wisdom. That's how we transform suffering into happiness. So let's just sit here. Your kind attention. You know, just a little under a half an hour, we'll come back for last sitting and chanting and maybe another little offering to tuck you in. So enjoy the night here.